Making Links. Transcription poems by Alan Sutherland, from the words of Tony Heaton. Rules of Engagement. When you think about the Camden Town painters, they just looked out of their windows and painted what they saw, or their friends. This is why I never quite understand why people don't get disability art. You know, you look back at great paintings, Picasso, Toulouse-Lautrec, Degas. They painted what was there, you know. They painted the people and the places that they hung out in, and it was contemporary. What was happening right there, right then. And I think that's what disability art does. It engages with what's happening right here and right now, and what it is that creates barriers for us as disabled people. I think that's interesting. But I would, wouldn't I? Just as you do. RTA. It was dark. It was December. It was probably quite horrible, greasy road. And I was, well, it's classic. Some guy in a wagon turned right in front of me. I was coming in the opposite direction. He was parked in the middle of the road here, and he started to pull in front of me. So I started to go round the back, and of course, as soon as I started to do that, lost the bike, so the bike slid on its side. If the guy had have carried on going, I'd have just slid down the middle of the road, probably been fine. But he, once he saw me, he probably saw the bike flip on its side. He banged his brakes on, and I thought, shit, you know? The next minute, I was underneath the wagon. I vaguely remember being in the middle of the road. I vaguely remember people being around me. I vaguely remember being in the most intense pain I've ever felt. And then I don't really remember much. Home. My dad was a motorcyclist, so there was always motorbikes and taking stuff to bits and putting things back together going on. Somebody just brings something along and say, can you have a look at this? And he'd say, yeah, what is it? It's a this, all right, start to look at it. He'd trained to be a coppersmith. That was his trade, coppersmith, and he worked for Leyland Motors. You know, straight in the factory, making trucks, buses, tanks, all that stuff. And my mum was at home looking after kids. So it's probably a fairly straightforward working class existence. Strict rules. Rules of engagement. This is what you did. This is what you said. This is how you looked. This is how you behaved. Proper. Growing up. I guess when I was young, there was still very much that sense of austerity, that things were going to get better. We'd just go in the woods, collect firewood and make a den, light a fire, stick some spuds in it, you know. We were pretty feral, really, up and down trees. We were frightened of nobody. You know, kids are frightened today, aren't they? Eight of us with spears, half naked, running through a wood. You wouldn't fuck with us. Growing up. I guess when I was young, there was still very much that sense of austerity, that things were going to get better. We'd just go in the woods, collect firewood and make a den, light a fire, stick some spuds in it, you know. We were pretty feral, really, up and down trees. We were frightened of nobody. You know, kids are frightened today, aren't they? Eight of us with spears, half naked, running through a wood. You wouldn't fuck with us. Trialing. We started riding motorbikes when we were 11, 12 years old. We did BMX-y type things. You know, we'd ride through streams and kind of overset up things, you know, planks of wood. Then you'd go over and really narrow things. We used to do time trials and nobody ever beat me. I knew that track like the back of my hand. And I could drive through woods, through streams. I was quite a competent rider. So it was I'm slightly scratching my head when I had a road traffic accident. Legal. It's kind of an irony, the fact that I'd been riding a motorcycle illegally for 5 years, you know, flying through woods, delivering paper round in the morning with no helmet or anything, just woolly hat, big coat. Never seemed to be any police around when I was a kid, you know. It never occurred to me that I'd get stopped and someone would say, "Can we see your license?" Of course you can't, I'm fucking 11. So I then finally became legal. I got this legal bike, had an MOT, I got a driving license, I got insurance. And fuck me, a couple of months later, I had this traumatic accident. Transfer. It's all very hazy. Probably got a shot of morphine. I vaguely remember being on a board, and one of the neighbours brought my mum to see me. My dad was at work. And again, it's all very hazy. And the next day, they transferred me to the spinal injuries unit. I just remember being in an ambulance with this small Chinese nurse, and we seemed to be in it hours and hours and hours. I kept throwing up, mostly blood, pretty horrible. And she was having to clean me up and must probably have been quite a mess, and we got to Southport. I could hear seagulls, and it was bright blue sky, you know, and it was December, a beautiful day. Some of those days you get this fantastic blue sky, and I could hear these seagulls. And I thought, where the fuck am I? I just thought, oh, I must be on the seaside. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm obviously down south because it took hours. What you don't realise at the time is the ambulance goes at 3 miles an hour because they don't want to bounce or vibrate you. They know you've got a spinal injury. But they transferred me out of the ambulance, and this guy who I now know, who was called Mike, he had a birthmark, really big birthmark, all one side of his face down his neck. I was sort of laid in traction on my back, and I could see his left-hand side. Big man, and he was very loud. His laughter was really loud, and then he turned round, and it's like this purple face, and I thought, what the fuck's going on here? And I didn't know whether I was in reality or not. You know, is this some weird, am I in hell? You know, where am I? What's going on? Because you've got no control over anything. This mad guy laughing outrageously. And it was almost like he did that, ha ha ha, you know? And it's from this sort of perfect side of his face to this very big birthmark. It's almost like, you know, very theatrical. But whether that's morphine or not, I don't know. I was saying, will I have to have an operation? And they said, no, you won't have an operation. Then about an hour later, they got me ready for theatre. Apparently some visiting surgeon from Sweden just happened to be there. And he said, we will do this experimental thing that I've been doing. So I got the springs, you know. I don't think they do that anymore. He basically drilled into the good vertebrae at the top and bottom, put these 4 springs, 2 on each side, which you can see on the sculpture. Spinal cord injury. I don't know how many nerves I've severed in my spinal cord. Not all of them, obviously, because I'm incomplete. But you know, how big's the spinal cord? It's like a fucking telephone wire, isn't it? How much damage? Well, not even millimetres. You know, you're measuring in thousands of inches, aren't you? Which is why it's so difficult to fix. You can't fix it, such a complicated bunch of wires. And yeah, I mean, slightly more damage, you're completely paralysed. You only have to do a small amount of damage, you're fucked, aren't you? On the ward. It was a mad regime. Get fucking dressed, get undressed, and then you'd get undressed, then you'd go for a wash. Christ, going down for a wash in this big sluice room, like being in the army, you know? Just toilet after toilet. Toilets didn't have doors, just had curtains. You could hear everybody having a shit. Smell awful. But when you were eventually, a guy came and evacuated your bowels. And you could smell him, you know, coming down the ward. Fucking hell, he's getting nearer and nearer. Couldn't see much because you were in traction. His name was Jack, so we called him Jack the Evac. He'd put a rubber glove on, dip his hand in some Vaseline, stick his finger up your arse, you know? Horrible. Pain, you could feel the pain, horrible. Anyway, we don't want to talk about that. Springback. I just thought the interesting thing was the juxtaposition of medical springs with motorbike springs that were on a bike. The idea that I would call it springback is part of springing back from a traumatic accident. I often call it a self-portrait. And I had to nick the x-rays from the hospital because they wouldn't give them me. There's always like this big orange envelope full of x-rays. They just leave them hanging around, don't they? So I just secreted the two I wanted, rolled them up and stuck them down the back of my chair. They're quite interesting. They've got the little tag on it, so it's got my name, date of birth, all that. So it's quite autobiographical when you look at it. Making progress. I didn't really see myself as a disabled person. I always thought I was going to get better, that it was just taking a long time. And that's probably because I'm incomplete. The doctor said to my parents, he'll never walk, he'll never have children, and he'll probably die round about, maybe before he's even 40. Prognosis for someone with spinal injury wasn't great, you know, back in 1970. Bladder infections, kidney failure, it wasn't. Or you'd get a pressure sore, and the pressure sore would kill you. My early life was, you know, urine infection after urine infection, really. And it grinds you down. But I started to get, I could move my big toe. No, can I? No, I could move a muscle in my thigh. I thought, I can move that. And it was, I was still in hospital, and I thought, can I move it? Because then they talk about muscle spasm. It's basically what happens because you're not using your muscles. They atrophy, shrink. You'll feel pain because they're shrinking, and they might twitch. And it's a nervous, it's a sort of automatic response twitch thing. I didn't have much sensation in my legs, but they said, you know, there's a lot of trauma, lots of bruising around that area. So as the bruising and the swelling goes down, we'll have to see what happens. So I just started getting this. I thought I could move that muscle in my thigh, and that's all I did. I was like a tinnitus, I just all the fucking time twitched the muscle, did it all the time, and it did get stronger, you know. I was obsessive for years, 2 years maybe, all the time, everything I could move. I'd be like a twitching speed freak, really, just twitching and moving whatever I could. Physio. The first time I got up, sat up, was awful. They literally threw some clothes at me and said, okay, you can get up now. Who's going to help me? Nobody. If you can get dressed, you can get up. Can't get dressed, you can't get up. All right, fuckers. Get half a sock on, knackered. But it was tough love. You had to get dressed. If you couldn't get dressed, you couldn't look after yourself. You couldn't manage. You weren't going home. Young woman in physiotherapy, she took me up the steps in the hospital. Every step was killer, because you've got two full-length calipers on. Couldn't bend your knee, literally got to sort of wobble. You know, flight of stairs, walk all the way along, down the stairs at the other side, all the other way back along. She must have had immense patience, because that took a long time. It was incredibly tiring, you know. It was dragging your body. And she'd just sort of walk along half a pace at a time. Come on, you lazy bastard. You never thank people, do you, for these things? It was tough, but you had to become robust and get on with it. So I was out of there in 3 months. It was a record time. Nobody'd been out that quickly. Homecoming. And I came home. My dad used to carry me upstairs. Extraordinary to think about it, you know. Literally carry me upstairs. He went in his shed and made a wooden support for the wash hand basin in the bathroom. Said to lean on it to have a wash. So I basically didn't drag the wash hand basin off the wall, you know. No fucking OT, physio, home visits, none of that. He carried me up to bed and had a wash. Spent a lot of time in my bedroom. Mates would come round, skin up a few joints, get stoned, and that was life. You don't inquire why. Then I went to art college. Art college. Some of my mates were going to go to art college, go to Lanchester Polytechnic, try and get in the Royal College of Art and all, you know. I'd think, how the fuck am I going to go to London in an invalid carriage? Where am I going to live? So I looked round, and the most accessible art college was at Southport. I knew Southport, because I was at Spinal Injuries Unit there. Amazing, they accepted me. I didn't think my portfolio was particularly good. Maybe they just thought, well, all right, you've got a talent that we can develop. I did a year's foundation course, which was great. I loved it. And that's when I discovered that I was really working class. Discovery. If you live a working class existence on an estate full of people like you, they're all like your dad. They all go to factory. You know, at Christmas, you go in their houses and their houses are like yours. Their kids are like you. Then you just go 18 miles down the road and suddenly different world. There's people with cars and money and stuff. Very privileged. So I guess, you know, being 17, 18 years old, suddenly realise that there are people with a lot more privilege. Valid carriage. I had a picture. I'd painted a picture of, I can't remember if it was Black Sabbath, some album cover with some devil's head on the roof inside. And on the door, because we used to call them Noddy cars, I painted a picture of Noddy and Big Ears on the sliding door. Big Ears has his arm round Noddy, and he had his hand down Noddy's trousers, squeezing his balls. And it was like a cartoon, Noddy and Big Ears. I remember going to the Bickershaw Pop Festival with about 6 motorcycle outriders. You know, we were all doing 45 miles an hour, because that's about as fast as the invalid carriage went. So I was sort of in the middle at the front, with all these motorcyclists, Hell's Angels behind, driving down the middle of the road. Quite ludicrous. I can imagine it looking like a ludicrous thing to see. Recovery. I think I probably said, I had an accident, I'm getting better. They probably thought, by the time he gets here, he'll be walk better. Yeah. So I don't think there was any intention. But I did think I was getting better, you know. I was getting better. You get more mobility, you move around. I'm 16, I'm strong, I'm young, I'm fit. You know, lot to be thankful for. If you're going to have a spinal injury, have one when you're strong enough to recover and mentally able to just take what's coming at you. Then I guess it dawned on me that I wasn't going to get much better. Because the rate of progress stopped, you know? I'd kind of got all the strength, movement back that I was going to get, really. And so it was always, walk with a stick, use your chair, walk with a stick, use your chair. You know it was. I use my chair an awful lot more now. I did leave art college. I got kicked out of college because I wasn't a particularly good student and I wasn't really interested in the art that was on offer at that particular place. I think art's an old guy's game, really. I don't know, maybe that's madness, maybe it's not an old man's game, but it feels like there's a lot to learn to get to a place before you start to really think about and appreciate work, particularly work that's gone before. I mean, I used to skip past the marble carvings to get to 20th century work, to get to what's now. And it's only when you start carving marble that you realise how fucking difficult it is. And then you start to think, well, hang on, this was made in the 15 and 1600s. Didn't have power tools, no really good steel tools, no light, no electricity. Phenomenal, really. You wonder how that work got made. Stunning. I was too young to go to art college, really. Filling in. I started working. I just did a series of meaningless jobs. Can't even remember them. Working in factories, printing. Printing, mostly. Printing machine manuals for Atkinson vehicles. I got married, had a child. Did graphic design, painted signs, made posters. So made a bit of a strange sort of living from doing creative things, commercial creative things. I did that for a few years. I had a printing press in the living room of my house to print jobs off on. Bit mad, but there you are. Record shop days. I had some money left over and a shop came up, which had been a wet fish shop. It was one story. My sister-in-law saw it, said, "Hey, there's a shop for sale." So I bought it. And me and my best friend Mark and my dad set to knocking all these blue tiles off. Stunk of fish. It had penetrated the tile and the grouting round the tiles. So we just knocked it, made a counter. I'd bought some second-hand records from a guy who had a shop in Preston. He wanted to get out the business, he wanted to go into nightclubs, and he had 2,000 LPs and some browsers. Got this massive big mahogany mirror, and we screwed it to the wall, painted it matte black, and it made the shop look really big. It was called New World Records, tagline, a haven for the musically insane, all records guaranteed round, some bollocks. Moving on. One of my great friends died when he was 21. That was a very traumatic time. He got into the Slade School and he wandered off to London. And then he died. 21. I can still see his funeral in my mind, in this little church where my daughter went to school. And I can still hear his mum wailing. His mum was quite old, got caught in a change of life sort of thing, you know? So she always seemed much older than everybody, more like his grandma than his mum. And her wailing was just dreadful. That anguish and grief and awful, awful. And you know, guys, girls that knew him just kept to the back of the church. What the fuck's this? First funeral I'd ever been to. Horrific. You can't believe it, can you, when like your good friends died? And for no reason, didn't get wrapped up on a motorbike or anything. It wasn't a proper death, just fell over. And he had so much talent. So I just decided to go to university. Essay. I did the Access courses and the Can You Write an Essay courses and all that carry on. I remember doing an A-level question, again externally, and Stephen Sartin, who was the keeper of fine art at the Harris Museum in Preston, and he was the tutor, and I was gutted that I got a really bad mark. And he said, "It's a brilliant essay, but what you have to remember is the people who mark A-level papers don't necessarily know very much about art. So they get a sort of crib sheet that says, did you mention full names? Did you mention dates? Did you mention key pieces of work? You know, compare Constable and Turner. You know, the classic exam question. You can't deviate. You can't create a unique discussion around Turner and Constable. You've got to, basically, you've got to follow a formula. I'd got no fucking idea you had to do that. I thought I'd written a really clever essay. And once he said that, I thought, fuck it, then that's what you do. You know, it's just a matter of counting the beans. It's cynical, really, isn't it? Essay. I did the access courses and the can you write an essay courses and all that carry on. I remember doing an A-level question, again externally, and Stephen Sartin, who was the keeper of fine art at the Harris Museum in Preston, and he was the tutor, and I was gutted that I got really a bad mark. And he said, it's a brilliant essay, but what you have to remember is the people who mark A-level papers don't necessarily know very much about art. So they get a sort of crib sheet that says, did you mention full names? Did you mention dates? Did you mention key pieces of work? You know, compare Constable and Turner. You know, the classic exam question. You can't deviate. You can't create a unique discussion around Turner and Constable. You've got to follow a formula. I'd got no fucking idea you had to do that. I thought I'd written a really clever essay. And once he said that, I thought, fuck it, then that's what you do. You know, it's just a matter of counting the beans. It's cynical, really, isn't it? Wave Rock. We started an access group then, and we modelled the front of the museum. Ian Hamilton Finlay, the brilliant Scottish sculptor and concrete poet, he made the front for the Harris, the Wave Rock sculpture, which is brilliant, you know. It was seen as one of the most innovative access solutions, and it was in this poxy little gallery in Preston. Nobody'd ever heard of it. What he did was create a drum. So the steps went up there, the drum was here, and the ramp, you went towards the steps, and then you went round. But as you went round, you got higher and higher and higher. And when you came out the other side to join the steps, you sort of did this three quarters of a circle. And he carved in the drum, big stone drum, and it just said, Wave Rock. And what Finlay said is, the people are the wave, and the museum is the rock. So the rock is changed imperceptibly by the wave, just as a museum is changed imperceptibly by the people who visit it. Beautiful sentiment for a two-word concrete poem. He was a genius, really. Identification. My best tutor at university was Paul Hatton. I've just been to his funeral, he's just died. But he was the guy, we went on Morecambe Beach, so we just walked on the wet beach, making stuff, you know. Andy Goldsworthy was making interesting work in the environment. He's probably a couple of years older than us. It's like, okay, what would Goldsworthy, rock, pool, leaves, you know, shapes, and we'd all get on the beach and walk off in different directions. And Paul Hatton said, I always know where you are. I said, how? What do you mean? He said, well, your footprints are different than everybody else's. So there are a lot of footprints over there. I know there's 10 students there, 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 and there. And I know Heaton's there. Because your footprints, your feet stick out, your crutches make. And I went, ah, yeah. He said, it's very distinctive. Perhaps you ought to think about how you can use that in your work. I thought, yeah, all right. Making tracks. So I did the easiest thing in the world. Get some plaster, take it down and walk across the beach, get some seawater, get some cardboard, and some, you know, just paper clips. Make a plaster cast, put it over the footprints, fill it with plaster, end up with these plates with footprints in it. And I just exhibited that work in a gallery. One door there, one door there. And then these footprints and crutch marks just walk, basically meandered from one door to the other. And then I extended that by getting some false legs from the ALSC, the Artificial Limb and Appliance Centre. So I'd like false toes, false ankle, false below knee, false. And basically had them, again, walking across a room, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So the footprint went from artificial toes to just incrementally bigger. I was making work like that, really. Lead line. It's a line of three tree trunks, about 9 inches high, about 15 inches in diameter, roughly sawn. And I lined them up, but not in a straight line. And then I carved a channel out of each one. So the channel on this one is roughly in the middle. The channel on the next one is quite close to the edge, so... But it's quite spinal. It's quite, you know, vertebrae. And then this lead is planished, hammered into the groove, which is probably about 2 inches wide, and lapped over the edge. And it's quite hammered into the wood surface, but the thing that connects the wood together is the lead line. So there's a soft bit of lead, you can see this bit in the middle here, which connected the wood together. So the wood, the tree trunk circles, don't touch each other, but the lead connects them all up. And I made quite a few works like this. I really enjoyed it. Lead's an interesting material. It's quite poisonous as well. Melting it down, probably not the best of ideas. I just love the way that you can hammer it, and it changes shape, softens out. It's quite soft, malleable, but it's got great history, you know, and guttering cathedrals, all that. Six Circles. And then, this is a very early work called Six Circles, 1989, carved out of elm trunks. Again, it's about reconnecting. So this is the same tree. These are five quite big. These are probably 30 inches in diameter, maybe even more. That's probably 4 inch, what do you call that thing, floorboard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 18, 27, 36. Yeah, so probably 36 inches across, the diameter of that. So all these bits of tree belong together as a tree trunk, and somebody cut them into slices. So I wanted to reconnect them by carving a circle into the top of each one. And this is squaring the circle. This is where squaring the circle came from, way back in 1989. So it's trying to reunite this broken circle, but the lead connected each one. But this, you don't need the lead. You use your brain or your eyes in your brain, because you look at the circle and you make a circle out. Can you see that? You look at that and it becomes a circle in your mind. I used to do lots of work. Come back to this idea over and over again, this idea of reconnecting things together. I'm sure there's a psychology to it of trying to reunite broken bodies. I'm sure there is something deeply related to the, you know, to the psyche of how do you reconnect things, how do you rebuild things. And lots of my work, you know, plays around with that. Like Split. Split. The wood turner said there's a shake in this piece of wood. I can't remember what. It might be ash. Yeah, ash. There's a great split down it. And I just had it in the studio probably for 2 years. What the fuck am I going to do with that? I didn't want to turn it into smaller bits of wood. I wanted to keep it as one piece. I thought, well, how do you? How do you make something with a rend, a great rend down the middle of it, you know? It's a beautiful thing. You could see. You could see inside the crack. The wood tearing, you know, still connected. So as the wood splits, you've still got that, almost like a, like chewing gum stretched inside it somehow. And then I just thought, it's a fucking split. Just carve the word split into it. Job done, you know. got some chisels 3 hours later or whatever. You know, S on the side, PLT. And again, it's like you're, you know, you talked about Great Britain from a wheelchair, and like you see it or you don't see it. Split's exactly the same. People either look at it and go, but, you know, they don't get it. And then suddenly, or some people just look at it and straight away go, split, yeah, good one. The eye's the crack, isn't it? You either get it or you don't get it. It's funny. Same with Great Britain. You either get it or you don't get it. Remembrance of things past. You don't know how injured your head is, do you? Like fractured skull. What does that mean? Is the damage that they know? Did they care, you know? I mean, I had a broken ankle, but they never set it because they didn't figure I'd ever use it again. So it's just basically put in a woolly, you know, like a sheepskin boot to protect it. But it was never properly set or fixed or anything. Bizarre what they used to do in the old days. My memory's terrible. My brother's got a brilliant memory. I've got a shocking memory. I don't know whether that's... How do you know whether it's, like you say, chemically damaged or physically damaged? Or, you know, I had a fractured skull. I mean, my ear was full of blood. Partial hearing loss as a result of it. Nobody actually said, by the way, you've got brain damage, or it's likely to affect your memory or anything, so I'm guessing that my bad memory is down to head injury. But it might not be. Wheelchair entrance. A lot of my work was around the way I engaged with the world. So an early piece would be wheelchair entrance. You know, suddenly coming across an art gallery, and the only way you could get in it was up 4 steps. So how do you respond to that as a wheelchair user? Well, you build a fairly temporal piece, which is a piece of 2x1 inch wood. You write wheelchair entrance, and you hang it in a doorway on 2 bits of string at wheelchair height. And what you try to do is then enter the consciousness of people who walk up the steps and think, what the fuck's that? You know and realise it's slightly inconvenient. They've got to duck under it or move it to one side. And when curators say we can't show that work in the gallery, oh, why not? Well, it's breaching health and safety, and it's people could hurt themselves on it. And you think, I've made an art piece of work. It's political. It's potentially dangerous. Surely that's good. Not rejected on the grounds of health and safety. A lot of the work played around with that. Northwest Shape. A woman from Shape in the Northwest called Joyce Morris came to one of my exhibitions at Lancaster and said, "Oh, are you a disabled person?" She said, "Oh, do you know about Shape?" I said, "Never heard of it." But I was making work that had a disability context. And she said, "Oh, yeah, there's this. We work with disabled arts." Ooh, and that's when I was thinking, yeah, but I'm not really disabled. You know, I'm a working-class bloke. I had a motorcycle accident. Yeah, I use a wheelchair. It was classic denial that, hey, I'm not disabled. Of course, what happens later when you're more politicised is you can say in your head as many times as you want, I'm not disabled. But the minute you connect with another human being, they immediately go, ah, you're disabled. It's very rare that people don't ask personal questions. They don't think anything of it. And I don't think they mean to be offensive. But it often is offensive. A bit of a drag. I saw disability as, well, I didn't even see it as a personal tragedy. I just saw it was something that happened to me. And it was a bit of a drag. But I just had to get on and get over it. And sooner I'd do that, the more I just am assimilated back into the world that I've come from. And yep, I'm a bit of an oddity, but, you know, my sparkling personality and outward goingness will just get me over that hurdle. I think that's what many people do. Well, you have 2 choices, don't you? You do that, or you retreat into a desperate world of death, I suppose. So, yeah, I was always out and about. And I had the ubiquitous blue invalid carriage to get around in. Out of ourselves. I was still sceptical and dubious of this. And I remember going in, and the first piece I saw was Adam Reynolds and was the lead suitcase. And it was in a corner, this beautifully crafted lead suitcase. Like one of those 1930s, 40s leather suitcases, but it was made out of lead. And it was open, and it was full of dead leaves, and the leaves spilled out into the space. I was like, fuck! That's a massively powerful piece of work. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was really good. And that was it then. I just thought, yeah, this is all right. This work stands up. Who wouldn't want to exhibit with? I didn't know him. I'd never met him. But I met him there and then. And I thought, yeah, what a nice bloke. What a great guy. I think it was probably the first joint show of disabled artists about disability arts. We never thought about that at the time. And it was. I think it was a vanguard moment, and I think it was a unique moment. And I met loads of nice people. But you just meet, you know, like, fuck, that was great. And you don't think, oh, yeah, he's a blind, he's a deaf, you know. It's just like, here's a bunch of nice people, we're having a few beers and they get it, and they're like me, they're young and they want to do things, they're angry about being excluded, and they're doing something about it. I can identify with this group of people, and they bring me different experiences. Because, you know, I'm still a northern bloke, really. I'm not really escaped from that. And this is suddenly when the penny drops. You just want to go, wow. You know, let's go to London. Fucking hell, yeah, it is amazing. Let's check out all this stuff that's going on. There was interesting things happening, but it was very localised. I always say it was a bit like abstract expressionism in New York in 1940 or whatever. Probably about 50 people were aware of it. Disability arts was the same. You could probably name the 50 people who were fully and truly engaged in it. Old Black Dog. I remember he was manic depressive, and he wasn't out about it. Until there was something happened, and he wrote a very long letter about his black dog. I'd no fucking idea what a black dog was. And he was saying, yeah, I fucked up. But you never think about me as a disabled person, but I am. And there was, we didn't fucking know you were a disabled person. You never told us. Yeah, you're manic. You know, you're fast. You're efficient. You write things. But the opposite side of that is desperation. Everybody's against you. And, well, you know what it's like to work with people like that. And it was that thing. Are they part of this? Are they really disabled? It was very hierarchical, actually, wasn't it? And there were real debates about whether learning disabled people should be part of the movement. Mental health, was that a disability? Mental health. It's extraordinary now when you look back at it, because it was like oppression within oppression. On the board. So, Joyce Morris then. Oh, you're young. I said, yeah. And we don't have anybody on our board that's young. Why don't you join the SHAPE board? She basically gave me a briefing on what a charity board was all about. And I thought, do I want to sit with these boring old farts, you know, from Manchester University and the City Council, you know, all worthy people, and it was the great and the good? And then I thought, they keep giving me work, you know. 200 quid a day to go and do a workshop in a mental institution or a day centre or something. Quite useful money. And I ended up being the chair of the board before I left. I was actually chair of SHAPE in the Northwest. Radar. Somebody just poked it in front of me. said there's this organisation in London called Radar. They're looking to appoint field workers or development workers in the Northwest. You could do that. And I thought, well, yeah, I've just done social administration and psychology. I know a bit about this disability arts malarkey and this sort of burgeoning civil rights idea. Yeah, why don't I? And they said, oh, we're going to pay you 12 grand a year and give you a car. Fucking hell, that's all right. That's quite a lot of money. What do I have to do? Well, you've basically got to develop a grassroots disability consciousness in the Northwest. Tell them about Radar. I mean, the weird thing about the politics then is the Greater Manchester Coalition of Disabled People suddenly hated me because I'd suddenly got into bed with the enemy. They perceived Radar to be a very conservative, and it was a conservative organisation. So they were radical disability-led, you know, banner-waving, hard left, and I'd suddenly jumped ship and had sort of left that hard line to get a cushy job, basically. And I remember going into Manchester Coalition, grrr, and I said, look, do you want some Radar keys? Oh, yeah. Here's an accessible hotels guide to the UK, or all the Radar publications. You know, I just fucking give them to people. And Radar keys, which were ridiculously expensive in those, I can't remember how much, they were like £3. I don't know, whatever they were, and I'd just give them out to crips whenever I saw one. You know, here's a key. But I got into places of power. Access groups. I remember going to places like Chester and setting up an access group, using allies in building control and planning, writing a 10-point plan for an access group. Say, look, stop complaining that you can't get in the fucking library. Do something about it. I'd organise disparate groups of disabled people, often in day centres, saying, look, you've got to self-organise. You need to recruit a chair and a secretary. You need to keep minutes. You need to meet regularly. You need to be properly thoughtful and constituted. And then you'll get a dialogue with your local authority. You'll get to see all the plans and you'll learn about planning and you'll influence planning decisions. That's exactly what happened. I saw it as a very radical thing to do. I was going on Radar's money, in Radar's car, with Radar's resources, and setting up access groups. And some of those access groups are still going, 30-odd years later. In the front door. The Spastic Society of the Isle of Man said, could Radar send a speaker for their annual general meeting? And I was looking at the TTs. The TTs were either the week before or the week after, and I said, I'd love to be your keynote speaker, but I can't make that date. So they said, yeah, all right, we can shift the AGM. So they moved their AGM. I flew from Blackpool to the Isle of Man. And they hired me a fucking car, which I couldn't drive, because they didn't realise that I was a wheelchair user. I got to this building, 20 steps at the front, fuck it, back door job. I went all the way round the building, how the fuck am I going to get in here? And people were wandering in, suits and dresses and everything, and I said, excuse me, are you going to the Spastic Society? I said, can you find this guy? I think his daughter had cerebral palsy. I said, can you find this guy? He's an organiser and I'm guest speaker and I can't figure out how to get in. And he sort of came through the door and he was totally stressed. Because they'd obviously said there's a bloke in a wheelchair outside. We didn't know you were a wheelchair, bound to a wheelchair or whatever. And they got me in one way or another. Must have carried me up. Or I must have bummed it up. But it's so typical. You know what? That happened over and over and over again. Citizens Advice Bureau. I was doing work in Radar with the CAB. How can we make them more accessible? How can we deliver an understanding of disabled people's rights within CABs? And I thought, you know what? This is a really interesting organisation, because it is about rights, social justice, information. Information is power. And a job came up, area development officer, a couple of thousand quid more money, and it was another car, you know, so yeah, all right, time to move on. And that's what I did, and again, I worked for the CAB, but again, a lot of the work was driven around disability. And again, I was coming to London every month, just like I was at Radar, and finding out more about the, you know, the administrative side of managing change. So I was doing art, and also, you know, quite deeply involved in administration and politics. Creation. I was doing all sorts, but doing exactly what I do now, which is sit down, think about art, evaluate what your process is. So what I formulated then, and what I still adhere to now, is a process that says, you're a creative person, and you can think about art all the time, because you think about art looking out the window in a boring meeting, or on a train, or in a taxi, or having a conversation like this. So you don't have to go and sit in a garret and think, OK, I'm going to be a sculptor now for 2 hours. It won't work. So always an artist or always creative. Bring creative thinking into all you do. That's rule number one for life, really. So I always made sculpture, and actually the process was I'm working, I get reasonably well paid. That gives me the freedom to make the work that I want to make. Inspiration. The other thing I realised is that the process could be quite slow. I didn't have to rush to make art, so I could just write things down, put things in books, do drawings, and store ideas up. The original drawing for Great Britain from a Wheelchair, I think I still have it somewhere. It was written on the back of a melolin pad, which is a heel dressing. I used to get in bed at night and change. You know, I had an ulcerated heel, which I still have. And it stops me walking as much as I might like to walk, because it breaks down. And so I'd always have a pad and some micropore tape on the bedside table. Every night I'd put a fresh dressing on. And I woke up in the middle of the night with Great Britain from a Wheelchair rolling about in my head. So I drew it. Just drew it on the fucking 2-inch by 2-inch square wound dressing. That was the sort of idea, and I just kept that for ages. Think I just stuck it with the micropore into a drawing pad, you know? And that, probably 2 years later, became Great Britain from a Wheelchair. I wish I'd made it straight away, really. Making Great Britain from a Wheelchair, 1. I don't make a lot of stuff that I throw away, because usually it never gets made. So the idea gestates for a long time. It probably kicked around in a drawing book for ages, just sellotaped into the drawing book with a bit of micropore tape. And then you just go through a massive thinking process. It's about what will it look like? Could you make it using bits of wheelchairs? And, you know, big wheel there, you almost assemble it in your brain. The pushing handle, that could be like Scotland, because you've got this series of islands coming down. That could be 6 backrests or 4 backrests or whatever. And, oh yeah, that could be that. And a little wheel could be Wales. You know, maybe a bigger jockey wheel for Wales. And you could use the brakes for the bit of Cornwall, the thin bit that goes out. It's got a ball on the end of it. I mean, you sort of assemble it in your brain, really. Making Great Britain from a Wheelchair, 2. I literally ripped the weather map of Britain out of the Guardian newspaper, stuck it on an epidioscope, projected it against an 8-foot by 4-foot sheet of plywood, got a fucking great big fat felt pen, and just drew round it. put it on the floor, started to take two wheelchairs, I think, to bits, piled the bits up. Then it was just a fucking jigsaw puzzle. Two wheelchairs completely took to bits, a box with nuts, bolts, screws, whatever in it. And my rule was that I couldn't use anything that was external from that. So everything had to come from those two wheelchairs. It was just a matter of putting things in place, you know, the lining up holes, bolting things together, cutting the armrest, you know, cutting a bit out the armrest for this bit. Dead easy, really. Squirreling. It's process. Ideas come. If I think they're worth it, I jot them down. It's a bit like squirrels. Hide some food, deal with it later. And when I think about it for a while, I think, well, okay, if I did do it, what material would it be? And how big would it be? What would it look like? And I sort of just keep pushing the process forward. The great thing about that kind of process is I don't end up surrounded by millions of failures. I only really make the things that I think I want to make, and that might have, you know, that might stand up for themselves. Titles are really important to me. I think about art as almost a sort of tangible philosophy. So it is, how do you wrap thoughts, ideas, and explanations into form? I'm reluctant to admit this, but there is a huge intellectual process that goes into thinking about the work, the materials, the title, and what I'm going to say about the work. And that's important that, as a working-class northerner, I'm not comfortable about admitting that, because it smacks of intellectual, namby-pamby, middle-class pooftery. So don't tell anybody. Rigour. I'm a working-class person. You take motorbikes to bits, you put them back together. You get covered in oil, you swear. But I devoured books, you know. Me and my dad never really got on. We were at loggerheads. But the older I get, and of course he's dead now, and I can't have this discussion with him. But he was right, always. I was too stubborn to realise, too thick, you know, and too reluctant. But he didn't present it in a way that was accessible and acceptable to me. He got the message right. He failed to get the delivery of the message right. The message was, you read books and you learn things and you apply that to practical things and they will be successful. There are no shortcuts, even though you think there are, and you want there to be. And I know this because I, like you, have tried every shortcut. Doesn't fucking work. So you do have to follow those rules to achieve what you want to achieve. But he never had the patience to explain that. So I'd just say, yeah, but fuck that, I'm just going to go from 3 to 7 to 10. And he'd just say, then you're a fool, slap you around the back of the head. Yeah, and say, what a waste of space you are, and I'll say, fuck you, and I'll show you. And sometimes you could, and then he'd say, yeah, you're so smart. And sometimes it wouldn't, and he'd say, there you are, I fucking told you. And he'd win more often than I, you know. Over 10 rounds, he would win 7 of them. It's about, you know, it's not just about the message. It's about the delivery of the message as well, isn't it? And I, as I slowly become him, you know, I suddenly realise that you do things, and you can do things intuitively. And you can also read and learn and apply, and you can do things that way. And having rigour is actually quite important. Whether you're making art or writing or driving a bus, it doesn't matter what it is, does it? You need to apply rigour to it. I think it's one thing that disabled people actually have a standing start on, or whatever the word is. Because we are great planners and organisers and strategists. We don't apply those terms to it. We just think, fuck, if I'm going to get through life, I've got to do X, Y, Z. Better make sure what's plan B. Okay, we're okay. And what's plan C if plan B goes tits up? And we do that all the time. I do it. I'm sure you do it. I have contingencies for everything. And actually, you can apply those contingencies to being successful in what you want to do, whether it's making a piece of sculpture or running an organization. So being disabled has taught me huge amounts. Probably taught me a lot of patience as well, you know, and slowed me down. Otherwise, I'd just be another motorcycle statistic on a tombstone somewhere. Ride fast, die young. Holton Lee. My partner saw this advert in The Guardian, I think, and said this would be a brilliant job for you. It's running this amazing, it's what looks like an amazing place, called Holton Lee. And you know four aspects, the environment, spirituality, disability and the arts. And I said, this is an evangelical Christian hotbed of nonsense, you know. And then I thought, fuck it, apply. It was probably about 10 grand more than I was earning at the time. And again, the carrot of the car. Applied for the job, got an interview. What's the worst that can happen? We can have an expenses paid weekend in pool. The unthinkable thing that could happen is that I'd actually be offered the job. And I distinctly remember saying, look, they're going to want a retired vicar or a retired social services person or a military person, actually, because it's all public school boys and we know who runs the charities in this country. I thought the last person they're going to employ is a long-haired radical sculptor who's, you know, got my track record, really. But Sir Tom Lees was an unorthodox man. Interview. I'm on the sticks, go for a pee, one of those little brass lock things. Zipped up, washed my hands, got hold of the little brass thing to open. It fell off in my hand. I was locked in the bog. So I, like, put the stick out of the window. I fucking climbed out. My balls are hanging on the fucking thing. That's, you know, the bit that you put the window-opening thing on. Dragging myself. It wasn't easy. Fucking hard work climbing out the window. What would you do in your first 6 months? I'd fix the fucking toilet in there. That path needs fixing. This is ridiculous. How can you have this? I just went on a major rant. I controlled and relatively polite. I didn't say fix the fucking toilet, but I said there is a huge amount of things that are wrong here. And you know, you've got to get the foundations right before you can even have these big dreams that you're talking about here. These dreams are rhetoric. We need to get the reality in place, and you need to do this, and you need to do that. And I remember them saying, well, there's four aspects here. I said, look, I'm an artist. I know about art. I did environmental art. I lived in a rural place. I went running around in woods. I've worked on a farm. I went birdwatching. I was in the Boy Scouts. I know about trees. I know what they're called. I know about nature. I'm not an environmentalist, but I know a huge amount about it. I know about disability. I'm a disabled person. Politics of disability. I said, I know nothing about spirituality. But you do. As long as you do, that's all we need. I'll do the three things. You do the bit that you're good at. And I fucked off out. When I'd got back to Cumbria, Tom Lees had sent me a really long fax. It was on the fax machine when I got in, saying, would you like the job? Investment. I rang Bert Massey at Radar and said, Bert, I'm thinking about taking this job at Holton Lee. They've got 3 months running costs. Fucking great. 350 acres. It's a blank slate. I can make it fantastic. Who can I go to for money? And he said, ring Peter Attenborough at the Rank Foundation. Tell him what you're doing. He said, well, we're investing in leadership and excellence or something like that. And he got me 60 grand within weeks. And I just got my sleeves rolled up and I worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week there, really. I invested a huge amount in Holton Lee. And I was 40, something like that. You know, I was in my prime, really. I felt I'd got knowledge. I felt I knew shit, you know? Making it happen. The world felt like a great place, you know, and it was like, fuck it, New Labour, let's get on, let's reinvent this place. It was quite euphoric. And we did, I think we did great things. I remember talking to the people at the Art House, and I was frustrated because it took me 3 years to build Faith House. They just said, fuck me, we've been fundraising for 10 years for the Art House. We're still not there. I was there 12 years, you know. We built Faith House, the artist studios, all the paths, tramper wheelchairs. You know, we transformed things like the Dutch Barn. I mean, the artist studios, they were a fantastic resource. You know, we did up the ceramics place. We did the barn for the office. And the, you know, that meeting room at the end. We did the cottages up where my office used to be. Submission. One of the outstanding examples of the Holton Lee Open was Sue Austin, you know. And she sent me a piece of work when she was a student. It was the fucking underwater wheelchair. And as soon as I saw it, I couldn't wait to get the bubble wrap off it. It was like, what the hell is that? It was a photographic print on aluminium, and even through the bubble wrap, it blew me away. Exciting image. Talking to Sue Austin afterwards, she said, oh, I hesitated to send it in. You know, I didn't think you would like it. And you think Sue, really interesting artist, lots of confidence, and having a bit of a dilemma about whether it would play, fantastic. And she's gone from strength to strength. 5-year plan. I think every 5 years I really sit down and work, what's the next plan? What's the next 5-year plan look like? And what do I need to do to get there? And what's the next 5 years? When I get to it, what's that going to look like? So I always do a sort of life and work planning. And for me, life and work are one and the same thing. Everything I've done, I've wanted to do. I've been really lucky. But it's also been, it's that the more you practice, the luckier you get sort of argument. I've been quite thoughtful in setting out a plan of things. So I knew I wasn't going to be at Holton Lee forever. Building buildings. You know, building buildings is not something to take on lightly. It's massively stressful and problematical. And most people build one. Fuck me, I don't want to go there again. I built 3 just at Holton Lee. But I loved it, you know, working with someone like Tony Fretton, the architect. You just learn so much. Just searching for that knowledge and learning stuff. I just thrive on that. And that informs your sculptural practice when you go back to it. Shape. I want to go in and invent something, create something, develop something. I'm a development worker, really. So that idea of being a development worker for Radar, it was a completely open book. Develop whatever you want to do that empowers disabled people. So I thought, okay, what do I want to do? Access groups, you know, working with social services, town halls, planners. That will work. So at Shape, it was, what do I want Shape to be under my directorship, you know? This is what I want it to look like. So I had thought what I wanted it to look like, and then I set out to try and achieve that. So things like Adam Reynolds Bursary, Shape Open, working with British Council, building a better relationship with the Arts Council, you know, working with mainstream galleries in London. These were all things that I thought I wanted to do when I applied for the job, and they were all things that we've got on and done. Shape. I want to go in and invent something, create something, develop something. I'm a development worker, really. So that idea of being a development worker for Radar, it was a completely open book. Develop whatever you want to do that empowers disabled people. So I thought, okay, what do I want to do? Access groups, you know, working with social services, town halls, planners, that will work. So at Shape, it was what do I want Shape to be under my directorship, you know? This is what I want it to look like. So I had thought what I wanted it to look like, and then I set out to try and achieve that. So things like Adam Reynolds Bursary, Shape Open, working with British Council, building a better relationship with the Arts Council, you know, working with mainstream galleries in London. These were all things that I thought I wanted to do when I applied for the job. And they were all things that we've got on and done. Handover. I just thought they'd build the archive, thought it was a done deal. We had the architect, we had the plans in place, you know, we had everything. I thought everything was in place. I thought they'd get a really good director, because Holt and Lee had got 10 years, 12 years track record. I thought it'd be a really juicy job for somebody. I thought somebody interesting will get the job, and they'd ring me up and say, Tony, give us a lift with this archive. And we'd all go down and we'd build the fucking archive, and Shape would be involved in that. And instead they said, you know what, we don't want to do this, it's not part of our agenda anymore, and they killed it. Sent 350 grand back to the Arts Council. Fuck me, that's criminal. Getting started. I thought visual arts was a niche area that wasn't being addressed by any other organisation. What I really needed to do was re-establish Shape's credentials in many ways as a leading disability-led arts organisation. So it was really important to get really good artists doing really good work in really mainstream galleries, because that would get us a lot of attention. And by getting the attention, we could very quickly establish Shape as a leading visual arts disability-led art organisation. It was a pretty crude strategy, but it worked, you know? So that's what I started to push towards. Some people on the staff team thought, yeah, that's a good idea, that's where we should be going. And some people didn't, and they left. And that's what happens, you know, you don't get fazed by that. You just recruit people in to do the jobs that you want them to do, and they buy into your vision and off you go. So the first few months were certainly months of change and redirection, and that can be a bit rocky, so you've got to hold your nerve. You're not going to be everybody's best friend, but you know, eventually, you're going to move the organisation into a better place. Bursary. The real catalyst for me was making the Adam Reynolds Bursary work in those early days. Adam had not long died. He was a personal friend, so I really wanted to establish an annual bursary in his name, because I didn't want his contribution to disability arts to be lost. I don't think it would have been, actually, but I thought the bursary was a really great way of continually reminding ourselves as a disability arts community, movement, whatever we call it, of the value that Adam brought to it, and the fact that he was a huge, huge loss to what we were trying to achieve. And I'm really pleased that the bursary is not only given an opportunity to some artists who we know, but it's also given some real opportunity to artists we'd never ever come across before. We're not part of the disability arts movement. So it's been a really good vehicle for bringing in new artists who are good. It goes from strength to strength. And part of the strategy is to take it to different parts of the country. So it's not always in London, and it means that disabled artists in different regions can get a better chance from an access point of view. Because not everybody can come and hang out in London. It's important that we offer the bursary to people where, you know, if they want to travel from home because they've got a setup that meets their access needs, then it's important that we can do that. I think it's been really successful. The problem with our sector, Alan. The problem with our sector, Alan, is we light candles and build sort of foundations, then we don't get the critical mass, do we? Because Holt and Lee's gone off in a different direction. But if there was a Holt and Lee and a Shape doing what we're doing now, and somewhere, three or four different places doing what we're doing, if the archive was established in a building, you know, it would strengthen what we're trying to achieve. Because you need great artists, you need great work. But you also need institutions to sell and promote that work. It's very interesting that whilst we within Disability Arts see it as a driver, almost as a life force, really, the rest of the world just doesn't even know it's there, does it? Putting it together. Getting information out to people, you've got to really hammer it home. It's got to be simple, straightforward. So it is, here are good quality artists bidding for a bursary in the memory of a really good disabled artist in a really good contemporary gallery. You start to put all that together and you've sort of got to be able to be on a winner, haven't you? So just get it established, really. And the thing is, once you've done it once or twice, you then start to build a reputation where you... You know, in the early days, I had to go and knock on people's doors and say, look, this'll be brilliant, you'll really enjoy it, it'll be great, don't worry, it'll all work. Nothing'll go horribly wrong. To the point where people are now coming to us and saying, we'd love to host the Adam Reynolds Bursary. Which is what you want. You want galleries to go, do you know what, we should be hosting this, because it's a really good thing. So that's fab, you know. It's great that that's happening, and the same with the Shape Open. Shape Open. What I wanted to do with the Shape Open is say, well, we've done high-quality, good artists. I mean, I always laughingly call the Adam Reynolds, it's a bit like Turner Prize for disabled artists, you know. And I think it's up there. But the Shape Open is aimed at a different group of artists. It's opened up. It's really, though good established artists still apply and get in, which is great. I don't want people to think, oh, it's only for emerging or young artists. I don't want people to think that at all. But it is an opportunity as an open exhibition that, you know, there's a fair chance that work will get in. And we get some good work, you know. The last exhibition, 40-odd, 50 pieces of work. All, I think, pretty strong. The last open. It was my swan song, really, going out, and we wanted something political. And also we are in a political time when we are back full circle in many ways to where we were when you and I were a lot younger. Going, you know, fuck them. Let's get the banners and let's get these politicians to realise what they're doing to us as disabled people. And I think first time round, I think we gave them the benefit of the doubt that they hadn't quite cottoned on to our oppression. But we can't give them that this time. They know full well what they're doing when they're killing disabled people, or denying us access to transport, or buildings, or jobs, or benefits, or whatever it is, you know? They're doing that knowingly. It's different. Different kettle of fish now. But we still seem fairly powerless to do anything about it, which is a worry. So yes, politics. In or out? We had all those discussions, didn't we, you know? Bloody disabled people, should they be in our gang? Mental health, is that part of our gang? You know, there was a lot of weird discussion going on, and that's part of the times, I suppose, isn't it? And some good rational and reasoned arguments about why people should be, why disability had to broaden. Because if we were looking at the social model and we were looking at barriers, then of course those people from those groups that were under question, I mean, it's hard to think we even questioned it or debated it. So bloody obvious, isn't it? You know, of course there are. You know they're facing barriers. Of course, within the social model, they're discriminated against. Oppressed. The shape of things. Yeah, I think shape's in a good place, but I would say that. Fortunately, I can prove it. I can point to things that prove it. I can point to boring things like, you know, the fact that income has gone up. But I can also point to people who've done amazing things because we've supported them. I just think back to the wasted opportunities sometimes. You know, the really interesting artists that were around in those early days when we were first kicking around in this disability arts world that we didn't even really know was a world. There's some really great talent that didn't get the investment to do really interesting work, you know. Some of them are dead now, some of them not around, some of them not doing this kind of work. Artists like Eddie Hardy doing amazing things. Aidan Shingler, you know, fantastic artist. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I'd have said he was right up there. You know, top of the pile for me. Very interesting case. I mean, they're always capable of that great work, but they just need the investment. Thoughts on being a disability artist. I make work that I think of that's interesting to me and that resonates with me. And if other people like it, great. If they don't, who cares? And it often has a disability reference or resonance within it. Because it's interesting, you know, it's interesting subject matter. So, you know, do I make disability arts work? Well, yes, but not entirely. Sometimes I do stuff that just interests me, for whatever reason. And it might be work that's trying to get you to another place. It is experimental, like stone carving, for instance. Some of my stone carving is definitely not what you would call disability arts. But it's more about exploring the medium, its experiments. But some of it absolutely is, you know. And a couple of marble pieces that I've done, very much based around disability arts, like Serpent Form. Serpent Form. Drawn from a conversation with Micah Hara, the visually impaired painter and sculptor, who I worked with down in Dorset, down in Holt and Lee. He was talking about losing his sight, and he was sort of almost describing, I can't remember, almost like watching a snake move. You can only really watch a snake move when you get it between two axis points. So if you watch a snake moving across a field, it's very, you know, just a flat plane. It's really hard to figure out how it's moving or how fast it's moving. It's only when you, because of the way it moves, it's not very obvious. And he was saying that losing his sight was this idea of a snake moving. That you knew it was happening, but you didn't know what the rate of travel was. So you knew you were a bit blinder than you were 3 months ago, but you can't actually remember how blind you were then. I mean, that sounds quite crude, but it was basically that sort of conversation. And serpent form came entirely out of that. It was this idea of carving the marble very thinly within the circle of his serpent form. So you got this quite nice twisty form, which is a beautiful thing to carve in marble. So it's quite tactile and sensual. You know, marble, curved marble that you can stroke is fucking sexy stuff. But actually, this very thin thing, where you can see this opaque light coming through and the veins in the marble, is very much like the idea of opaque sight, trying to see things through this slightly milky material. You can see light and shade through it, but very difficult to see. But when you look at the material, you can see veins in it. And it's a bit like when you have your eyes tested and that blinding light goes off and you see all those veins somehow. So for me to pack all that into that sculpture, that's what it's about. That's the end product. But if you were looking at it, you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, it's disability arts, unless I told somebody what it was. You wouldn't know. You'd think it was either a dull or an interesting, moderately interesting piece of carved marble. So it's about the stories as well, disability arts, isn't it? I think often titles and stories are really an important part of the package. Channel 4 Commission. I pitched a few ideas at them. The idea that I thought was the best idea was not the one they went for. And that happens, you know, with competitions. You've got to put 3 or 4 ideas together. And I pitched something called Raspberry Ripple, which is good old rhyming slang for cripple, in neon. And I thought that was the strongest piece for it. I wanted to make something that was subversive for Channel 4. But so subversive that they didn't know it was subversive after it was built. Because I think art's got to be dangerous again, in some way. Got to be more than decorative to be proper disability art. It's got to be almost propagandist, or, you know, agitprop sort of edge to it. I hadn't got a title for it when I pitched it to Channel 4. I had a few ideas what it was going to be called. The strongest contender was Monument the Unintended Performer. I thought if I'd tell them that, and tell them what that means, they won't like it. So we called it something banal as a working title. Monument to the Unintended Performer. It was mixing together this incredibly famous, iconic sculpture by its Discobolus, so it's his Greek discus throwing, so it's one of the early Olympians. It's this amazing marble carved figure of a discus thrower. That becomes a starting point for it, so that's iconic of the Olympics. And the iconic Crip image is the bloody stick wheelchair user, isn't it? Because that's the image that is. You know, if you ask people about to identify disability, they'd always say the stick, you know, the stick in the wheelchair. So I thought, well, somehow we've got to amalgamate the iconic wheelchair logo and the iconic Greek Olympian. So it was really just a matter of crunching those two things together, but using neon for the wheel and light for the discus, and using steel for the body rather than marble. And stainless steel, so that you got lots of nice reflecting light, and the figure was very fragmented. So it wasn't a full figure, it was, you know, a head, an arm, a bit of a chest, So there were various bits of body which were connected by virtue of the fact that they were literally bolted on to the big four. So it was a relatively simple mashup, really. And then, once it was up and done, I wrote the words, which they more or less hid in the window round the corner somewhere. Because it's called Monument to the Unintended Performer. It's not about the Olympics at all, not about the Paralympics at all. And it's a monument to all the performers who get stared at every day. You know, I get stared at all the time. Getting on a bus, everybody stares at me. Somebody walking down the street with a white cane. Everybody stares at somebody with a guide dog. Everybody stares if you've got any sort of facial disfigurement, impairment. People stare at you. My journey. I think part of my journey has been about making sculpture in a selfish way. That's my sculpture for me. And part of it has been about being able to administer a series of opportunities and see other disabled people who are very creative and very gifted do great stuff and deliver it. You know, I mean, I'll always regret the fact that we've not been able to achieve more, and we've not been able to have the influence that I wanted us to have. But we are fighting a sort of faceless minority, aren't we? Of people in power who don't want us to be exhibiting in a National Gallery, or the National Theatre, or the Tate, or the Hayward Gallery, or wherever it is. Wall of Power. People might say, well, it's not interesting enough. It's not important enough. If it was important, then people would have heard about it. But I don't agree. I think it is important. I think it's really interesting. They just don't get it. I think we've educated the subtle, you know, the white middle classes to not express that prejudice in open court. But I think they probably still think it, a lot of them. They just know they can't say it anymore. So we're still fighting that wall of power and rank that don't want us in there. Because they instinctively know that it means one of their kind has to give up their seat at the table. And they can't hack that at all.